Good morning. It's February 19th, 2013. This is the Finance Subcommittee meeting for the Health and Social Services, and welcome to it. This is today with me. I have Senator Berta Gardner being teleconferencing recorded. So please turn off your cell phones and Blackberries. This meeting is on Medicaid. For those of you who will be testifying, please remember to identify yourself, your affiliation before you begin your testimony. We have an hour and a half for the meeting. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Margaret Brody. I'm the Director for Healthcare Services. And this is a presentation on Medicaid. And if you follow along with the handouts, the first page, slide two, the purpose of Medicaid is to provide medical benefits to low-income people. The vision of Medicaid is Alaskan individuals, families, and communities are safe and healthy. The service philosophy, which you will hear time and time again, is to deliver the right care to the right person at the right time for the right price. Medicaid is an entitlement program that was created in 1965 by the federal government, and it is administered by the state. The funding for the program is both federal and state, and depending on the type of Medicaid, our money is matched either at 50% or all the way up to 100% for IHS services. On slide four is the organizational chart for Medicaid. It starts with the commissioner's office. And then there's the Deputy Commissioner for Family, Community, and Integrated Services, under which is Public Assistance. There's the Deputy Director for Medicaid and Healthcare Policy, under which is Behavioral Health, Healthcare Services, Senior and Disability Medicaid Services, Adult Preventive Dental. The Children's Services shows up on this side, but it's because it works so closely with behavioral health, but it is actually under the Deputy Commissioner for Family, Community, and Integrated Services. Public assistance determines eligibility for Medicaid, for all types of Medicaid. And the divisions under the Deputy Commissioner for Medicaid and Healthcare Policy are the ones that actually arrange for or provide the services for Medicaid and pay for them. On the next slide, it shows that behavioral health is responsible for the mental health clinics, substance abuse clinics, psychiatric physicians, residential psychiatric treatment centers, and inpatient psychiatric hospitals. Children's Medicaid services is for behavioral rehabilitation services for Medicaid. Healthcare Medicaid services are your traditional medical services, your physicians, hospitals, those types of services. Adult preventive dental is for preventative and restorative dental services for adults. Senior and disabilities Medicaid services is nursing home, personal care services, home and community-based waiver programs. For children with complex medical conditions, individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, Alaskans living independently, and adults with physical and developmental disabilities. All these programs work very closely together. Behavioral health and children's services provide the same type of services. For senior and disability services, many of the participants in those programs suffer from behavioral health issues such as depression. And healthcare services provide services to all recipients.
Before we leave that page, I notice under healthcare and Medicaid services, you have chiropractic care.
Yes.
Is that a common practice?
It's.
Is that a common practice?
Yes, it is.
Go ahead.
The next page is a graph that shows the spending and enrollment in Alaska specifically. Our spending and enrollment follows national averages for spending and enrollment. We feel the same effects as the rest of the economy, but we feel them just a little bit later than the rest of the nation does. We have an increasing elderly population in Alaska. Those numbers cause our expenditures and our rolls to go up. In Alaska, the numbers aren't quite as high as the national average, but in time, we expect them to get there.
Why do you think there's a crossing back in between fiscal year 2011 and 2012 there, where the enrollment number is more than the Medicaid spending growth?
That is where the economy started improving. That is also on the national charts also. The same thing happened.
Thank you.
The next slide shows our Medicaid expenditures by fund source from 1991 through 2012. As you can see, in 2012, we've had the smallest increase since 2008 in the budget. It's really, if you look at the percentages, it's really cyclical how it's really low for a few years and then it jumps up for a period of 4 to 6 years and then goes back down. And so we're right now in a cycle that's where we're at a lower increase.
Is that because there's a new commissioner on board or because something else is going on?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things.
Give me an example.
Well, the economy improving, people being able to make wages that put them outside of being eligible for Medicaid. Some of the other examples are the savings initiatives that have been put in place in all the divisions. That's two.
Okay, thanks. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. On page 7, the undesignated general funds, or rather the designated general funds, can you just tell me a little bit about what those are? Is that the tobacco cessation, or what are the designated fund sources?
I can't say specifically, but that dollar amount matches. I can look it up and get back to you with that.
Thank you.
Okay, the next chart shows the participation in Medicaid. In 2008, we had a decrease in the number of individuals enrolled in Medicaid. However, the number of recipients who utilized the services was at 95% and 94%. The most people utilizing services was in 2009, when expenditures jumped 5.5%, and enrollment began increasing again in 2010. In 2012, we had the highest percent of the population enrolled in Medicaid, with 92% utilizing services. However, expenditures did not increase exponentially. Major accomplishments in 2012. Total cost for direct services increased only 3.4% between 2011 and 2012, a significant change in the trend line indicated by the bar graph. The cost per beneficiary showed an even smaller increase of 0.4%. This cost saving success is attributable to numerous Medicaid cost containment measures implemented in fiscal year 2012. In 2012, both
Senator Gardner has a question.
Thank you. I'm still curious about places where the percent of enrollees receiving benefits has increased and the population enrolled, but the costs are down. Do we have any idea which categories are down specifically? Is it, you know, transportation, pharmacy, you know, different types of services?
We will be able to see that on another slide, but I was just going to give you what two areas are for sure. Both behavioral health Medicaid and healthcare services were able to decrease the amount spent per beneficiary during 2012. Behavioral health went from $12,041 per beneficiary to $11,613 per beneficiary, down 3.6%. Healthcare services went from $5,428 to $5,315 per beneficiary, down 2.1%. However, senior and disability services increased 2.7% from 43,652 to 44,844 per beneficiary. And that goes back to our aging population. To some of the savings that were realized were from pharmacy initiatives using generic medications, capitalizing on our dual eligibles. We also had national correct coding initiatives that were mandated by CMS, and these are edits that are put into the system that ensures that there aren't duplication of services or for the same type of services billed for in the same day. It also checks to be sure that the services that are billed for are gender appropriate, age appropriate, different things like that.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Can you explain what you mean by capitalizing on dual eligibles? Maybe I have that wrong phrase, but.
Ensuring that Medicare pays their fair share. Dual eligibles are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. So ensuring that they pay the maximum amount that they should be paying.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. The next section is on Medicaid forecasting. This year, we decreased our budget by approximately $25 million. And we did this because of our forecasting that we have done. We use Evergreen Economics to do our long and short-term forecasting. The short-term forecasting is called the STAMP, and it basically stands for Short-Term Alaska Medicaid Projections. We also do long-term projections, and that's with the MESA, using the Medicaid enrollment and spending in Alaska. Using the STAMP, we started doing that in 2007, and we intended to bring greater statistical rigor and departmental knowledge into the projections. And what that means is that we were trying to integrate what the different programs knew was going to be happening with their programs and what the financial projections were. So it is a partnership between the programs and between the people that do the forecasting. We wanted to be able to support the department's budgeting process. It relies on Medicaid spending and enrollment data. It includes historical trends and relationships between spending and enrollment, and it incorporates information provided by the managers and staff that operate the various programs.
So is this a nationwide program that you subscribe to, or are other states using this, and are they having the success that we're having here in Alaska?
It has been modified to meet Alaska-specific needs.
So it is a nationwide, it is a national program that you can get?
I can't say that it's a national program. It is a similar program is used elsewhere, yes.
Go ahead.
It's completed in three steps. They develop the baseline forecast for each appropriation. They allocate the baseline forecast across the sub-appropriations. And that's where, for the appropriations, it starts out with the different programs. It starts out with healthcare services. It starts out with behavioral health. And then the sub-appropriations are where you get into physician, pharmacy. It's the type of service that becomes the sub-appropriation.
Okay.
And then they develop the final STAMP forecast after taking in program-specific information. This forecast is double-checked against what we call the auth report, and it is a weekly authorization report that is run after every single check write cycle. We know what the spending is. We put it into the auth report. The auth report is a straight line projection. So it doesn't take into consideration things that we know might be coming up. For example, encounter payments and things like that. It's just straight line. So whatever we have spent, it'll project out over the number of weeks that are remaining. We also have three other methods of that we do internally to project spending based on past spending and enrollment data. And all these are checked together to see, are we in the same ballpark? What differences are there? Are there any adjustments that need to be made? And then the stamp is finalized after that. So it's not just a good guess. It's not just based on past history. There are double checks to be sure that we are accurate. And if anybody is interested, we do have a handout that I can give you on exactly how the stamp is done. Okay, this next slide is from the Legislative Finance Division and shows the spending among the different programs, with Medicaid services being the most, public assistance being the second highest, and then all grouped together, behavior health, children's services, public health, juvenile justice. So as you can see, Medicaid is the largest expenditure in the department. The next graph is another one from Legislative Finance. This is based on formula and non-formula spending, and of course Medicaid and public assistance are both formula, so you pretty much get the same picture. This next chart shows the spending in fiscal year 2012, with the total Medicaid spending being $1,369,633,400. This actually adds up to the top, so the orange is the total for each of the divisions. So for healthcare services, it was $744,093,000. For behavioral health, it was $166,601,000. Healthcare services accounts for 54.33% of the total Medicaid budget. Senior and disability services is next with 32.11%. Behavioral health has 12.16%. This doesn't take into consideration, as I said, the that one recipient can receive services in healthcare services, senior and disability services, and behavioral health services all at the same time. The remaining 1.4% is split between adult preventive dental and children's services. And the next chart just shows the picture a little bit better.
Before we leave that page, down at the bottom, you've got bring the kids home as the last entry there. Do we expect that number to decrease over the next several years as the program seems to be more successful?
I don't know, sir. I would have to ask Children's Services.
Okay. Go ahead.
These next few graphs are looking forward for what we have for our budget in fiscal year 2012 and what we are asking for 2014. So for Children's Medicaid Services, we are not asking for an increase. For Behavioral Health Medicaid Services, we are not asking for an increase. For Adult Preventive Dental, we are asking for an increase. In the history from 2009 to 2010, it grew by 13.4%. From 2010 to 2011 by 37.5% and 17.1% between fiscal year 2011 and 2012. Part of the growth in adult preventive dental is that we have allowed individuals to receive 2 years worth of benefits at one time. And the reason why we have done that is so that they can get upper and lower dentures at the same time rather than have to wait for the next year to be able to get their next set.
So So what happens if they do run into more dental difficulties next year and they've used their allowance?
Then we would refer them to another entity that might be able to help them. But if they've used their amount, they've used it.
Senator Gardner.
Did we have a lot of pent-up demand that has been met now, or do we anticipate continued growth?
We anticipate continued growth.
And that's as the population ages and becomes eligible for the services?
As the population ages and becomes eligible for the services and actually needs more services because of aging.
Thank you.
Healthcare services is asking for an increment of 3.295. This increment is in support of the anticipated woodwork effect. And what the woodwork effect is individuals who right now are eligible for Medicaid, but they haven't applied. And so when it becomes mandatory that everybody have insurance, we anticipate that they're going to apply because this counts as insurance for them.
Coming out of the woodwork, is that where it comes from? Okay.
We are anticipating approximately 1,500 people, and this increment is for half the fiscal year because it's effective January 1, 2014. For senior and disabilities Medicaid, we're asking for an increment of $10,486,000. This is, as our population ages, we're anticipating increased costs. This increment will support the anticipated increase in home and community-based waivers and personal care attendance services.
Well, I want the record to reflect that Senator Coghill has joined us.
Good morning.
Good morning. Can you just make sure we're all on the same page, Mr. Moody? What page are you on?
I just turned to page 22.
22. Go ahead.
Okay. A significant challenge continues to be effective control of the Medicaid Management Information System project. This is extremely important with all the changes in Medicaid, with the new Affordable Care Act, all the changes that have been made since we started the procurement of the new system, what we originally procured and what Medicaid is today are two different things. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done and incorporated into the new system. Right now, we're working with a system that's 24 years old. We process about 190,000 claims a week, and the payments range from a low of $22 million to a high of $37 million a week. The news.
Senator Coghill.
So what you're having to do at this point is double entry of everything while you're working the system up?
We are not double entering everything. We could be double programming things because we have to keep the old legacy system up and running and be able to process claims correctly. And the new system has to be programmed for all the changes that have happened in addition to what they had to program originally. So we're having to program in both. We're not having to enter in both yet because the new system isn't at that point yet.
So when do you think that you'll put the full weight on that new system?
We are anticipating the new system being up late summer.
Of 2013?
Yes.
Okay. All things going well, right?
Senator yeah. Gardner.
Thank you. And can you tell me how long this has been in process and if there are needs in Alaska that are different from other states? I mean, do we have to invent this, or aren't all 50 states going through something similar that we could maybe piggyback with?
This procurement has been going on for over 6 years. We are getting a system that is similar to two other states. However, every single Medicaid program in the country is different. Every state, every territory has a different program. So it had to be modified to meet Alaska's needs, which we're going to find ironic with the Affordable Care Act, because part of the eligibility is being streamlined and made to be the same across the country. So at the time that we procured the system, everything was different. Going forward, things are going to be very similar in a lot of states. So hopefully 25 years from now, when we do our next system, it'll be more streamlined, and we'll be able to just buy one that meets everybody's needs and be less expensive.
Follow-up, Senator Arden.
Thank you.
Continue, Mr. Moody.
Okay. And the next slide is just taking a closer look at the increments with the anticipated woodwork effect, which I went over. We're reducing our general fund program receipt authority. And we're reducing our interagency receipt authority. These are funds that we did not use. And we haven't used in a couple of years, so we're just eliminating the receipt authority. We're transferring statutory designated program receipt authority from senior and disability services to healthcare services. And the reason that we're doing this is that healthcare services is the division that makes all the collections for all the Medicaid programs. On the next slide, we're starting with the Affordable Care Act. There is no deadline to determine if we're going to expand or not. States that opt in may later drop out. However, to drop out, it is going to require a state plan amendment that has to be approved by CMS.
CMS.
What's CMS?
The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. There is going to be a cost to states even if they don't expand, because there are elements in the Affordable Care Act that we have to implement, and that is going to take personnel, it's going to take more funding for some services, and so it's going to cost more whether we expand or not. As of January 1, 2013, Medicaid increased the reimbursement for primary care physicians to the amount of what Medicare pays. That doesn't affect the state of Alaska because we're already paying over the Medicare rate, so there won't be any increase for us, but a lot of states will have that.
Before we continue, let's go back to interagency receipts. Where do these receipts come from, and what are their program receipts?
Some of the program receipts are for collections that we make. For example, if an individual that's on Medicaid is in a car accident, mm-hmm. and there is insurance from that accident, either they had car insurance or the other entity did, we go out and we collect whatever we spent in Medicaid from those insurance companies. So we have a lot of ways where we will recoup money from any third party that we possibly can. So we go out and get our money back.
And including IHS?
For IHS, yes, we will collect for insurance for IHS also. Okay. We actually asked CMS if they would like for us to do that, because we have nothing to gain by that, because the money goes 100% back to the federal government. But we had to be sure that we were in compliance with their rules and regulations.
Okay. Go ahead and continue. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Gardner.
Thank you. On the slide on page 26 about Medicaid reimbursement for primary care physicians, if I understand correctly, Alaska has for a long time reimbursed physicians at a higher rate than the national level. And if some places elsewhere are increasing their reimbursement, are we maintaining the gap? I mean, given that costs are higher here generally?
We did not increase them other than the normal inflationary increase this year.
Have we heard from physicians that this is a problem for them, or is that front quiet?
I have not heard anything.
Thank you.
Okay, as of January 1, 2014, Medicaid mandatory coverage for children between the ages of 6 through 19 will increase to 133% of the poverty level. This also will not affect Alaska because our CHIP program covers up to 175% of the poverty level.
Senator Coggio.
But the population will expand. So we will expand it to what degree?
Ms. Brody.
We do not have that information specifically because, yes, it will expand in some areas, but a lot of people are going to find themselves ineligible under the new income rules.
Okay, right. So that is yet to be determined.
Yes, sir. There be mental health parity benchmarks. The new way of determining if people are eligible is called MAGI, which is the Modified Adjusted Gross Income. This is using that data. It's called SIP, Survey of Income and Program Participation. And what has happened is the federal government has been doing surveys and determining what the average income in each state is. Our problem is that they did this in April. So they're determining what the average monthly income is. And so in April, we, of course, don't have very many PFDs going out in April. So that isn't being counted in the average monthly income. So we have written a letter to CMS asking them to modify how they count income in Alaska, that we annualize the amount of the PFD. And we used an average of 1,200. For the PFD.
So how do you go ahead and make up for the fact that only part of the population gets a PFD and not the rest of it?
That's what we did when we sent the letter in requesting that our income be modified.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yep. There's a lot of income that counted in the past that won't count in the future. Child support is no longer going to count towards Medicaid. Workers' compensation is no longer going to count. Veterans benefits, Social Security. So all these types of things that counted in the past in this state will not count going forward in any state. So you really have to think about what counts as income on your income tax return, because that's pretty much where this is going. If it counts as income on your income tax return, it's going to count for Medicaid. So that takes into consideration like step-parents' income, which we don't count now, and this is where we're going to lose children with their step-parents' income counting. Siblings' income counts. If they're counted as a dependent on the income tax, so teenagers that have jobs after school, their income is going to count towards the household now. And other tax dependents' incomes count. So whoever is on that tax return as a dependent, their income will count.
And
Senator Coggio.
This is under the assets and resource test?
That is just the income test.
Income test only.
Yes. The good news is that there's not going to be an asset test going forward. And that's after January 1, 2014. And that's going to be for people that are under the age of 65. So if they're on Medicaid and they're over 65 or they're on Medicaid because of a disability, the old rules apply. So we're going to gain people by not having the asset test anymore. We're going to lose people by having step-parent income and other types of income counting. And that's why we really can't tell. We don't capture the information that doesn't count now. So if somebody was ineligible because of a step-parent's income, then that income was removed because it was exempt here.
Senator Coggio.
So is our MMS system going to be able to capture this? Are they going to be able to step right into this program?
It is the EIS system that needs to capture the income. And we are also in the process of procuring a new EIS.
Right.
And yes, it will be able to capture the appropriate income. Another difference for the income going forward is that hasn't been exempt before are pre-tax contributions. So health care benefits, child care benefits, health benefits that we all have deducted pre-tax, those will not count as income going forward in Medicaid. Self-employment income here is going to be made a lot easier because it's going to follow the IRS rules. So if it's an allowable deduction for IRS rules, it's an allowable deduction for Medicaid. And the only other difference really is gifts and inheritances. Those don't count for income tax, so they're not going to count for Medicaid going forward. In January of 2014, enrollment's going to be simplified and standardized. There's protection against spousal impoverishment for recipients of HCB, home and community-based waiver services, through calendar year 2018.
Senator Coghill.
Just repeat that one more time. I want to catch up on that.
The protection against spousal impoverishment for recipients of home and community-based services through calendar year 2018.
Okay. All right. So, I got it.
Okay. Medicaid must now provide coverage for barbiturates, benzodiazepines, and tobacco cessation products. And if the state decides to expand, that is the very first state that we would be able to.
By reading this right here, according to your third bullet, benzodiazepines weren't covered initially, so people weren't able to get Valium? Is that true?
I could not answer that. I will get the answer for you. Some of these were covered under Medicare and not Medicaid, and now they're covered by Medicaid, but I will get the answer from our pharmacist for you.
Well, you tend to go ahead and give Valium to younger people, not to older people, because it causes them to stop breathing if they overdose on it for some reason.
I will ask our pharmacist and get back to you.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
The enrollment simplified, can you give us, I know that the enrollment for Medicaid regular and SCHIP were a little, had a variation in there. Does this kind of close the gap on that variation?
Yes, it does. Okay. This is with the income, the same income's going to count for both programs, and with the asset test going away. Yes, it does. And it also aligns it nationwide. But each state will have its own income level. That's pretty much going to be the only difference now going forward.
Go ahead.
And then in January 1, 2015, we're going to have new reporting requirements. A lot of the reporting requirements are going to have to do with quality. How well are we providing the services? And how responsible are we for the services that we're providing?
Any further questions brought about members of the committee? Senator Coghill.
One other question. With the Affordable Care Act, does this change the whole coding system that is between Medicaid and SCHIP? Not the billing coding system. I'm sorry, the federal coding. Does it change where they set in the Federal Register? Do they collapse into the same law, basically?
No, there will still be Title 21 right. And Title 19. Right. They still will be separated.
Any further questions, Mr. Board, by members of the committee?
The only thing, it still brings different rules to bear, and it'll be interesting to see how they fall out. So, I suppose makes it even more challenging to modify a state health plan, right, under
Yes, especially with the new system, because we've already built our health plans, and now we obviously have new ones.
Yep.
There's no further questions. Thank you very much for your presentation this morning.
Thank you, sir.
Commissioner?
Not me, I'm here, sir.
Yes. Do you have anything more to present this morning?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Bill Swear, Commissioner, Department of Health and Social Services. I have nothing to add to that. We will get the answers to the questions for you that were raised and get back to you as soon as we can. The Affordable Care Act continues to unfold for the department and for the state of Alaska. We continue to explore the options available to us and evaluate if we are going to recommend, if and when we are going to recommend an expansion to Medicaid. It's not a simple, easy process to get to that point. We have some good studies out there, the studies conducted by ANTHC and some of the national agencies reflect both the good, the bad, or the good, the bad, and the ugly of what can happen with a Medicaid expansion, and we want to hopefully get it right before we make a recommendation back. But we will continue to work toward that, and I hope to be able to be back before you to discuss the Affordable Care Act before the end of session.
One of the concerns I have about the Affordable Care Act, the name itself sounds like it's a pretty catchy phrase, but can the state continue to go ahead and subscribe to that in the near future, because we see the throughput going down and the state's revenues going down? How can the state go ahead and afford something like this?
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly why we want to get this right, because the Affordable Care Act is not a free lunch. And we need to seriously evaluate exactly what it is going to cost us, and whether 90% funding is assumed beyond 2019. In looking at the national budget, I don't know how that can be sustained, and we want to identify how much risk there really is there.
What are the preparations or other states doing to go ahead and try and get ready for, ramped up for this act that's coming down the pike?
Mr. Chairman, we do not anticipate at this point any additional funding required through fiscal year 2014. Mm-hmm. But should we decide to expand Medicaid beginning with 2015, there will be a healthy bump.
Okay. The question, though, was what are other states doing to try and prepare themselves for the Affordable Care Act as it applies to them?
I'm sorry. I missed a question, Mr. Chairman. Other states are, weighing it against, their overall budgets and weighing the value of it. Many states have left in caveats that if the rules change, their decision will change. Arizona has said that. West Virginia has said that. Michigan has said that. I look at some of the other states. I look at, for instance, Michigan has made a decision with a very conservative governor, has made a decision to pursue a Medicaid expansion, but their 14% unemployment rate, and affects a ton of people. So in the short run, they're hoping that because of the largesse of the federal government on the Medicaid expansion, that they will go ahead with it. But there is a caveat that the decision can be reversed at any time. So I think it's grab the money while it's there, and make a decision later if the money goes away. Approach that is being taken.
How do we stay away from these entitlement ideas or thoughts that go through people that are recipients, make sure the state isn't on the hook for them anymore?
Mr. Chairman, that's a whole subject of it of itself, and one of the things that I talk about is that we need to engage all three legs of the stool in healthcare: the provider, the payer, and the recipient. And there needs to be ownership on all three parts for the entitlement program, and it needs to be better linked to employment, needs to be better linked to moving upward in their social economic status.
Senator Caulfield.
Commissioner, are we given any more flexibility on the Medicaid rules for co-pays, for example? I mean, are we able to, within our state plan, or do we have to do something in statute to say If you want to get this benefit at certain income levels, we can increase a copay.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, that's a yes or no question. We are not doing enough. I do not believe we're doing enough right now to enforce the level of copay that should be required of recipients, and it's a system that we're evaluating throughout the department in several areas as to how much we can do, not only for Medicaid, but also our grant recipients.
I think there's a humaneness that goes with that as well. You know, I've known people that who were getting benefits of the Denali Kid Care because of children that had complex medical issues and were about to get a raise in their job. And because of that, it would have kicked them out of eligibility. It would have been nice if they would have been able to get a copay as they worked their way out on the raises up. But what happened was refused the raise, could not become any more productive in society, and depended upon us to carry that load, where they were willing to if they would have had some way to work their way out of it. And so I think the copay is something that we need to look at more significantly. So I'll be glad to work on it.
The last question I have for you has to do with the expansion of Medicaid. There have been a number of proposals that have been put out there with the possibility that the state can do well. The numbers seem to be conflicting, though. Can you just have a statement or anything on what the administration's position is on the expansion of Medicaid?
Mr. Chairman, the administration is waiting on me, and the exact reason the evaluation and making sure we're getting it right is because of the conflicting numbers. Depending on the perspective that you take, in other words, we'd love to see a Medicaid expansion, it's a rosier picture, then if we need to be very careful about this before we do a Medicaid expansion, and I need to make a recommendation, need to provide a recommendation, provide an overview to the governor that is unbiased.
When do you expect the numbers, and when do you expect to have a recommendation done?
Mr. Chairman,
is it a year, within 5 years?
I'm hopeful that we will have something prior to the kickoff date, January 1, 2014, for eligibility of expansion. But we can do nothing before January 1, 2014. And there's another piece in there, the health insurance exchange, that we have chosen the federally facilitated exchange, the FFE as it's affectionately called, and we haven't even seen a draft model yet, and that is supposed to be operational by October 1 of this year, and I don't see any way the federal government's going to come forward, because they right now have 23 states that have chosen the federally facilitated exchange, and none of us have seen a draft. Well, that federally facilitated exchange has to be altered. Designed around the state insurance codes, around state coverage benefits, around state plans, and around state health plans is what I mean, and around the general operations of insurance in that state. And so they all have to be modified, and I do not see how that's going to be able to go live in time. To
Senator Coghill?
Yeah, part of the question was answered, so, you know, I know that there's some uncertainty in even other regulations that will come down. One of the questions that in putting together your report, I would only ask you to get a little historical perspective in there, too. For example, some years ago on the ProShare issue, we were told one thing, and then as soon as we leaned on that, we were told another thing. So I think I can remember that was about $100 million or $50 million bump. And so if in looking back through those histories, it would be interesting to see, you know, we were told we would get an FMAT match at one level, and then it changed pretty dramatically a couple of years later. So it was we've gotten yanked pretty hard by the federal government as well, and I think we have to keep that historical perspective in there.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, yes, sir, we do. In terms of ProShare, shame on us, because it was not a covered service.
Okay, I'll take that. We thought it was, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, well, if there's no further questions by members of the committee, well, I want to announce that the next meeting is going to be on Thursday, February 21st, here in the Farrant Camp Room at 8 o'clock. We're scheduled till 9:30, and there'll be a continuation of our discussion on Medicaid. With that, we're adjourned.